right, everybody. Welcome into the latest installment of Going Nuclear with myself, Trevor Hall, and the Uranium Insider, Justin Hune. Justin, good to see you.
Good to see you as well, sir. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. It seems like we're in a commodities market. And I must say, it almost appeared that uranium led the way into this cycle.
It seems like it kind of did, right? We had a good move, you know, the second half of last year into the beginning of this year, and that sort of preempted the move in copper and precious metals as well. So maybe we were the leaders.
Yeah.
I'll carry that flag.
Well, listen, enough of us were pounding the table on these things for the better part of the last 5 years, and it was just almost a matter of time. Maybe it tested our patience more than we would have liked, but certainly it happened. No guests today. We're just going to keep the episode in conversation amongst the two of us, and
yep,
that's okay because there is a ton of things to talk about, but maybe we jump right into the main headline, Justin, regarding a U.S. ban on uranium imports from Russia. This was more or less a bipartisan bill signed and put into place by the Biden administration. It's going to have implications and all this, you know, the Department of Energy has been out there with a number of headlines and talking heads talking about this. From your seat, you know, talk about what you're seeing as implications, and, you know, does this kind of give it a foundation for this market to have a second leg?
I think it does. I mean, a second leg was expected regardless, but this is certainly, at the very least, sort of gumming up the fuel cycle in a way. It's not making things easier for utilities, both in the US and abroad, and it's not going to have any downward pressure on the price. So despite all of the nuanced takes on the implications on this ban, all of the elements, the waivers that are being offered by the DOE, the fungibility of the material, all of these things, take all of that aside, this is not making things easier or cheaper. So that's the primary takeaway that anybody needs to have with this. This is just one more handful of sand thrown into the gears that is the global nuclear fuels market. And it's certainly going to complicate things, at least for the near term, until the utilities that have have future reliance on Russian deliveries in the United States figure out a way to replace that material and or receive waivers from the Department of Energy. So there's a lot of nuance we could get into, but long story short, the implications are essentially on January 1st, 2028, there will be zero imports, waivers or not, coming from Russia. So that's, in the nuclear fuels world, that's tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So people are saying, oh, but there's waivers. Okay, the waivers process is not a cakewalk. A U.S. utility that wants to receive Russian enriched uranium between now and January 1st, 2028, what they have to do is they have to prove to the Department of Energy that they have exhausted all other options at any price and cannot get that material in that same time frame. So we already know that that's essentially not going to be the way that they will receive waivers. Why? Because the Chinese can sell them enriched uranium. Well, what's the problem with that? 30% tariffs in the United States to import Chinese enriched uranium. So, but that is a price point. That's not an availability point. So most likely what I think is going to happen is either they will receive a waiver based on maybe for this first shipment, right? Maybe they can't source it from anywhere else in time for this next shipment of uranium coming from Russia, right? Which is, you know, what, let's say 3, 4, 5 months down the road. The other option is if they can make the case that it is in the interest of national security for them to receive that that shipment. That's a little bit more of a gray area. Don't really know how they can make that case. So it's complicated. Perhaps they can buy expensive material with the tariffs from China for this next shipment. But beyond that, it's not going to make financial sense for them to do that on an ongoing basis. So it's a complicated sort of mess. It really is. The utilities are not happy about it. The DOE is holding a pretty hard line. They're kind of like, what if we have to? So there was a meeting on April 30th between the Department of Energy, the U.S. utility representatives, and the Nuclear Energy Institute. And there were questions in the room, you know, coming from the utilities like, well, what if we have to pay $200 for SWU? And the DOE was like, well, you got to pay $200 for SWU. They were just basically like, sorry, if it's going to cost more, you guys played your hand well. You got cheap Russian material for the last 20 years. This game is over now. And you're going to have to figure out a way to deal with it, essentially is what they're saying. So there's not a lot of clarity on the waivers process in terms of how gracious they will be, but it's not looking like it's going, they're not going to be giving it out like candy. So it's a complicated process. Long story short, it's going to put upward pressure on the prices across the fuel cycle and make things a little bit more complicated for US utilities and to some extent European utilities as well.
Yeah. Justin, when there was discussion regarding a ban on Russian metal like aluminum and nickel, it seems like the West somewhat backtracked that idea because of it would cause too much volatility in the market. Things would get really out of hand, expensive. So I'm a little bit surprised that they did make this move on uranium, just kind of given that track record with the other metals. But listen, I think there's a little bit, I mean, I guess, is there a little bit more production of uranium in the West than there is nickel and aluminum to kind of hang their hat on?
There's plenty of uranium in the West for US and its allies. I mean, there's plenty of uranium in the United States. It's just largely in areas that are not supporting uranium mining. You know, Arizona and New Mexico, for the most part, there's an enormous wealth of uranium in those two states. But there's uranium supportive jurisdictions in Texas and Wyoming, Utah, and we'll be able to produce a bit more. We'll be able to produce all of our national needs, 45 to 50 million pounds a year. And yeah, that's not going to happen. But we can at least get up to maybe 5 to 10 million pounds a year in the next few years. That is, I think, is possible. Ton of uranium in Canada and Australia, obviously. So allied countries have a lot of uranium. It's not, that's not the problem. The problem really is the enriched uranium. And the reason that they were able to go ahead with this ban and why it was supported is because banning this material and passing this legislation also unlocked funding to support the domestic production, the domestic support of increased capacity for both conversion and enrichment. There's also elements to this funding that requires a certain amount of this conversion and enrichment domestic production to buy domestically produced uranium. There also is another bill with more funding to continue the uranium strategic reserve, the federal strategic reserve for actual U308 for Yellowcake. That's going to continue. That started last year, kind of got held up. That's going to actually continue now. We believe that's going to continue for a 10-year period of time where they'll be buying a small amount of uranium coming from domestic producers. So basically they're saying, I know this hurts. It's going to hurt for a minute, but we're also going to be funding this that's going to support that domestic production. And in time, we'll bring those prices for conversion and enrichment back to kind of the global average level or possibly even lower them once that capacity is online. Of course, that depends on the demand, which is also growing very, very quickly right now. But long story short, the US is just like, we've got to get off this reliance. And in order to do that, we have to tear the Band-Aid off here. And it's going to hurt for a minute, but we'll give you waivers if you literally can't find it. And we're also going to support conversion enrichment domestically so we can get over the line and actually be self-reliant for nuclear energy, which is almost 20% of the grid in the United States.
To their credit, and I'm not one to give credit to government agencies lately, Justin, but just as you say, from the Department of Energy in a little bit of a news release after this was announced, they said, we recognize that a transition away from Russian source fuel will not happen overnight. I'll give them credit for that so they understand this. They also said the ban is essential to strengthen the nation's energy security and supports the development of uranium conversion and enrichment services right here in the U.S. that will result in thousands of new jobs for Americans across the country. Great. I mean, love those words on paper or on the website, obviously. But there's going to be following steps that need to be taken, whether it's under the Biden administration or whichever administration follows, right? So what are these next steps to make sure that nothing falls through the cracks here, Justin?
Well, the initial steps were getting some of these pieces of legislation actually over the line, getting the president's signature and getting that funding released. So the actual releasing of the funding is really the biggest kind of quote unquote first step. This has been a long time building. I mean, this goes back years and years really to recognizing the frailty of the state of the domestic nuclear fuel cycle in the United States with an absolutely vital element of our industry and our GDP and our electricity grid. So this goes back 2018 with the, you know, the Section 232 petition from Energy Fuels and UR Energy, which kind of was a nothing burger, but that led to the Nuclear Fuels Working Group from President Trump at the time. That actually got held up because of 2020 election year craziness and COVID and all of that. So that just fell to the wayside. But that did build the foundation. And so a lot of the DOE people are lifers. These are career people. They've been through many different administrations, Republican and Democrat. And they've been working on this for a very, very long time. So this is not just a partisan political, you know, ploy here. This is something that has been building for a very long time within the DOE. So as far as we can tell, whichever administration takes over, you know, following the elections later this year, the DOE should largely stay intact, and we should continue to see this this support for the domestic nuclear fuel cycle and nuclear in general in the United States. So with all of that said, the funding being released is the big important piece of that. Conversion is arguably the largest bottleneck. And we have a converter here in the United States that's ConverDyn. It is jointly owned by Honeywell. Honeywell is a government contractor. So if the government is saying we're putting up funding for conversion and we want to expand ConverDyn, it's probably going to happen. We do know that ConverDyn has the capacity to expand. They're currently producing 7,000 tons a year right now. They could move that to 12, 13, possibly even a bit more than 1,000 tons per year with a relatively inexpensive, relatively easy expansion process. And I say that, you know, knocking on wood, but they can do it. They have told us that as such. So will they do it? They don't want to just expand willy-nilly because they went through an extremely difficult process of having to shut down their operations back in 2018. They're not going to expand capacity just to kill their own business. But if the government is saying, here's the funds, we would like you to do this, we want to support the domestic nuclear fuel cycle, you're going to do it. It's probably going to happen. So not holding our breath on that, but within a couple of years, hopefully they can start that expansion process. That, of course, will free up more conversion capacity, more UF6. More UF6 you have, the more the enrichers can actually overfeed. They can utilize more of that feedstock, produce more material faster. That's going to help everything, especially if we're cutting ourselves off from Russia, which is the biggest player in both of those markets.
Okay. There's going to be a lot more news out of this. It's going to, I think every month we'll see something new about how this kind of continues to develop and roll, you know, in progress, I guess, Justin. So let's continue to table this because that was sure. Pretty big news since the last time we spoke. You know, I want to kind of get kind of nitty gritty here on equities in the uranium space. And I got to ask you about this NextGen deal about taking on debt to buy pounds on the market when they have this massive project of their own up in Saskatchewan in the Athabasca. But before we get there, let's get people pinned in here because we are going to talk about that. But in general, the equities of uranium, you know, they were cooling off the last time you and I chatted. You know, how are things sitting here? Were expectations a little too frothy previously?
It's hard to say that there's too frothy because the fundamental backdrop is just it's improving on a daily basis, almost on an hourly basis. It's absolutely insane the news flow that's coming through here. I mean, just yesterday, the UK announced that they're building out their nuclear workforce by 50%.
Wow.
The Slovakian leadership said they're going to double their nuclear capacity. They were already planning on building one large nuclear plant. They're going to build two. Last week or a couple of weeks ago, the United Arab Emirates, that arguably has the nuclear success story of this century, which is the Barakah plant. This is four large, I think they're 1,400 megawatt reactors that were built by the South Koreans on time, on budget for an oil-rich country. This is a trend we're going to continue to see. I mean, the AI data center demand and the focus on nuclear is something that kind of came out of left field, and this is absolutely real. This is happening. It's huge demand. The U.S. life extensions, the South Korean life extensions, the French life extensions, they had mentioned they would be life extending a lot of their older reactors that came online in the late 70s and early 80s. And that was sort of, you know, wishful thinking over the past couple of years. Well, they just announced they're getting a green financing to actually do this and life extend. And they've got, gosh, was it 30 plus reactors, so these 900 megawatt reactors that they're going to be life extending for 10 years. It's the news flow is coming through a fire hose. So to say the expectations were frothy, it's like, well, compared to what, really? Is there a reasoning for them to be frothy? I would argue that yes, there is. Looking at the charts, you know, most of these things have these gigantic cup and handles. If you look at URA, for example, there's a 10-year cup and handle where the handle itself is a cup and handle. And literally today, as we're speaking, they're breaking out. So we're seeing huge cup and handle breakouts. This is not one of those things where it's extremely contrarian, where these things are left for dead and they're dirt cheap and nobody believes it's going to work. That was a few years back, right? Now this is seriously a trend. Is this the first inning? No. Are we at the eighth or ninth inning? Absolutely not either. But we're seeing technical breakouts on good volume, literally as we speak. That's very nice to see. And the interesting part is that spot hasn't moved. Year to date, spot is flat. It's moving up a little bit today. So it's up a dollar from the beginning of this year. URNM is up 17% year to date, 18%, something like that. So we're seeing the miners outperform the metal after a very, very long period of an underperformance of the metal. So that is very good to see. That chart, metals versus the miner, miners versus the metals, actually breaking out today as well, breaking above trend line resistance. At the same time, the moving averages are starting to cross up. It looks good technically. All we need now for this to be a really, really strong move is for spot to move. And today feels like the miners are moving before the metal. And something is being sniffed out here. The market is sniffing this out. It's really interesting. This morning when I woke up, when the markets were just opening, I started to see I have some options positions on in uranium equities, and those were starting to price it in so that the underlying hadn't moved yet, but the options were starting to move. And usually on a shorter term, that's kind of a nod to what's coming. And an hour later, we saw the sector start to light up. So there was some smart money starting to move things in this morning. And we've been in sort of a horizontal consolidation for the past couple of weeks. It smelled like accumulation, and now we've got the volume breakouts happening here. So if we start to see spot continue to move up, which I think that we will here, because it's been, we peaked out at 106 second week of February, pulled back to 84 over the course of the following two or three weeks. And then it's been just kind of a nibbling, slow grinding back up. Spot has bought, 1.2 million pounds in the last 3 weeks. So we're starting to see some volume traded in the spot market. The price is starting to move up. Once we get back above 100 and then breach that previous peak, I think it's really going to be a very, very strong and potentially violent move to the upside. And that could happen. And that could happen in the coming months, which would be unseasonable. Usually May, June, July, August are very, very slow for this sector. And it's possible that this Russian ban is sort of going to change that this year, along with other things. We've got a few entities that are short uranium that need to cover. Holtec is restarting the Palisades plant. They're going to need to buy fuel. South Korean restarts are going to need to buy more fuel or life extension, excuse me. So there's a lot stacking up here in still a relatively thin market. And what we've gone through in the past 2.5 months in the physical market is just a very, very quiet period. Traders and utilities stepped out of the market following the doubling of the price that happened from August to February. Now they're starting to step back in. And the fact that we bottomed out at 84 after moving up from 50 is incredible. So I would say, if you're looking at the physical market, rather than say, hey, why did we pull back all the way to 84 from 106? Look at the higher low. We didn't go from 50 to 70 and pull back to 60. We went from 50 to 106 and pulled back to 84. Now we're back up to 91, 92 here mid-market in the middle of the day today. So very constructive looking price action for the commodity. We think it's headed much higher.
All right. Well, let's talk about that headline news out of NextGen Energy. They're not without their criticism here over the last couple of years. They have they've made a lot of money in financings. They've obviously a huge project there up in the Athabasca. They've taken some of that money, have done some sponsorship deals with a professional sports team and race cars. This one was, highly critiqued by investors. They have entered into a binding term sheet. They're going to buy 2.7 million pounds of natural uranium concentrate of U308 using a convertible debenture. So they're taking on the debt to do this. When they're supposed to be developing a project to produce that same U308. Justin, I mean, the market was not happy with them. I guess your reaction here, how were you surprised? Were you shocked? Were you angry? Not angry? Like, what were your thoughts?
You know, when there's something like this that happens, the first thing I do is kind of ask myself or ask the company, what do they know that I don't? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the first thing that I try to ask myself. Obviously, the market reacted to the negative side, both with, they had the financing announced and then they announced this deal right after that. Surprisingly or not, the financing went through at a significant discount or a significant premium to the cost of the stock that was trading in the open market and when it went through. So that's obviously a very, very positive sign. I think this is going to be one of those things that in hindsight, the market's going to appreciate what they just did. So why would they be issuing debt to buy pounds at $95 a pound? That's a question that only the company can answer, right? So I think that the market has already priced in that this project is not going to be producing on the timeline that they say. And that's not really a very insightful take. Mines always get delayed. Always, 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 especially for uranium. Across the board, universal. It's a universal rule in this industry, as you well know. So will they be producing uranium in 2027? No, of course they will not. Will they be producing in 2028? Maybe, but probably not. Most intelligent, let's say market analysts in the sector, even the banks that cover the stock, they're looking at 2029, 2030, and possibly even later. So the market, any delays that happen to this project, I don't think are going to be huge surprises. And ironically, those delays are probably going to be good for the stock and great for the price of uranium, because this is the biggest development project in the world. And the utilities of the world are really hoping that this does get built and gets built ASAP, while the investors of the world are hoping that it doesn't. Right? Because it's going to keep the price pressure under the price. So this particular deal is a little bit of a head scratcher, but at the same time, I assume that they know something that I don't. And this company has had a lot of criticism for its G&A, and I'm not going to be the one to defend it. But I'm also going to say that they're not just sitting on an asset milking shareholders. They are developing this. And they have checked all the boxes in getting this thing built. They're building this mine. So everything is happening on a reasonable timeline and they're getting it done. So management is executing. Are they being paid well for it? Yeah, that's an understatement. But they're certainly executing here and moving this forward. And this is a very, very important project. Will it get bought out? I don't know. Is it attractive? Should it be bought out? Absolutely. Everybody was pounding the table that Cameco should have done this back in 2020. They could have paid cash for it. I think it was ridiculous that they didn't, but here we are and the company is building it themselves. So they're going to hit some bumps along the road. Will we look back at this deal 2 years from now and say, was it brilliant for them to issue debt to buy 2.7 million pounds at $95 a pound? Probably will. We probably will. But there's also the element that for development projects, for them to have a physical inventory drastically de-risks the process of contract negotiations with utilities. So for this project, if you're a utility and you're going to sign a contract for first delivery in 2029, you're going to have some sort of reassurance that you're going to get that material if their development gets delayed. So if they're sitting on 2.7 million pounds, they want to sign a handful of contracts for 500,000, 1 million pounds delivery, 2029, 2030, they can sign those contracts with 100% de-risking because they're sitting on the material, whether or not that development actually happens on time. So this is a tool for them to negotiate contracts. And that's something that should have been obvious to the market. While I don't love every aspect of this deal, it also was a little bit surprising to see the violent nature of the reaction by the market to that deal. So either way, they are executing. I can't say that I love everything about it. I can't say that I love their cash burn, but they also are not just sitting on the sidelines. They're actually making it happen. And that's worth something. And it's one of those stocks. It's like, it's such an important project. It's such valuable rock. The stock has good liquidity. It's owned by all the ETFs. I think to fade that would probably be an error.
I'm really glad I asked you that question, because that puts a lot of different perspective on outside of the headline that most of us just saw. And I think if that certainly is the case, you gave it some justification, right? From the headline, it looks like they just kind of did their own trust, kind of like the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. But my follow-up question is like, well, what are they going to do with this uranium? And then I assume they're not just going to hold it. They're probably using it to sell and make some sort of provide some sort of offering down the road. I mean, they buy it at $90 a pound, you know, 2 or 3 years. What if they sell it for $150 a pound? I mean, that's a genius move. Yeah. You just got to get over that initial market reaction, like as you just said. And I think after listening to you, I think my temper has calmed a little bit over it. And I can see that.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, I'm not trying to be an apologist here. I'm just trying to look at it objectively. And if I look at any position of mine of any mining company in any sector, there's something about that company that I'm not very pleased about. There's something I've got to hold my nose about. Very few companies, very, very few companies operate with 100%, let's say, trustworthiness and shareholder benefit. Mm-hmm. You know, it's unfortunately, that's just the case. But, you know, this company has done an absolutely incredible job of furthering this asset. And if they had just found the material in the ground and sat there and milked shareholders for a decade, that's a different story. But they've made deals and agreements with all of the surrounding First Nations tribes. They're very close to making deals on the actual construction of the mine. Their environmental impact, not statement, but the impact application with the federal government is in process right now. They've had to make a number of revisions. That's just how it is when you're building a mine. You go back and forth with the entity at the federal government to get this approved. They're in that process now. They're already approved in the province. So they're getting it done, and they've got money that is being thrown at them. Their CapEx has risen. They've had to adjust that upwards. They're probably going to be north of $2 billion of CapEx to build this mine with a B, $2 billion. And guess what? That gets repaid in less than a year. I mean, this is an unbelievably high-grade deposit, and certain shenanigans, high G&A, doesn't make me happy. Obviously, doesn't make shareholders happy. But they're not going to kill the project. They're pushing it forward, and it's just too valuable. And it's probably a ripe takeout target. But nobody wants to build a mine. Like zero people want to actually build mines. They want to make a deal here. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, it's obviously nuanced. It's not 100% across the board a positive or 100% negative here. But I have a feeling that they know something that most of the retail folks that were upset about this don't. Mm. And most likely hindsight will show that that's the case. And it could be, I mean, it could be next month. It could be shown that that was a wise move, you know?
Yeah. Nobody wants to build a mine right now unless Western governments want the mine to be built. So right. There we go. Justin, let's keep it at that. I mean, obviously, those were some major headlines that we needed to cover. And we're going to do our best to find a guest for the next episode. But it's going to be interesting to watch how this market kind of continues to move forward. It sounds like it's got another leg up here this week. The entire commodities complex, and you and I got online and we were just laughing because it's been a long time. I mean, since the entire commodity complex kind of started moving, especially in the metals, and we had a little taste in uranium last year, but the other metals are moving just, you know, nicely. It's a good way to end the week, isn't it?
Oh, it's a wonderful way to end the week. It's it's so nice to see green on the screen, kind of across the board for us commodities investors.
And yes,
yeah, very happy for you as well. You've been you've been consistent with the metals for a very long period of time. And I know that especially gold and silver bulls were, they went through some trials and tribulations over the past few years, to say the least. So I'm happy to see that starting to turn, and hopefully it has some legs here as well.
Yeah, well, moves like this, is all well is forgotten and forgiven, I guess.
So true.
All right, Justin Hune, you can find him on Twitter at Uranium Insider. Follow his newsletter, Uranium Insider Newsletter. I'm on Twitter at Trev A. Hall, and the Mining Stock Daily Podcast. Justin, have a great weekend. Thanks so much.
You as well, sir.
The information presented should not be considered investment advice. Going Nuclear, Justin, or myself, and the Clear Commodity Network team and its affiliates are not responsible for any loss arising from any investment decision in connection with the material presented herein. Please do your own research or speak with a licensed financial representative before making any investment decisions.